Michael, thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be here. Actually, you were very generous in your remarks. I have to say, to my qualifications for talking about the subject today are entirely fraudulent. The last time I was speaking to the Global Strategy Forum, I said with very great confidence, I think towards the end of 2006, in fact, I even added the remark, you've heard it here first, that the next president of the United States would be Mitt Romney. I then, in 2007, took a rather expensive bet, actually, with an American friend of mine, and said I was quite convinced that the two candidates would indeed be Mitt Romney versus Hillary Clinton. So just put that into your, absorb that into your software, and then aim off for everything I say from now on. There's a very short answer to the question, does it need to change and in what direction will it change? The answer I could give very briefly is say I haven't the faintest idea. But we need to do a little bit better than that today. I think that the most important thing to remember, certainly as far as foreign policy is concerned, is that the new president will not be writing, if you like, on a blank sheet of paper. He will inherit a book on which there is much scribbling already. And this will, by definition, define, even constrain, his ability to set a new course in foreign policy. Now, there is a great yearning for a new course in foreign policy, and the first thing we have to ask is, then, different from what? And what is the second question is, and then, what is the scope for change? Well, if you're looking, there have actually been three Bush foreign policies, George W., that is. There was a relatively brief phase between Inauguration Day in 2001 and 9/11, when it looked like the Bush foreign policy was going to be a sort of pretty conventional mainstream type of thing, with Colin Powell being allowed to run foreign policy, with Bush and Condoleezza Rice going off and doing their own thing with Russia. But following a Democratic administration which had already started to toy with the notion of developing Star Wars and strategic missile defense. And then all that changed on 9/11, and we had a period from 9/11 which embraced the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, roughly goes up to the end of the first Bush administration, in which we saw the high point, if you like, of neocon influence on the Republican administration. And then in the second Bush administration, we've seen a kind of winding down, if you like, of the messianism, and something getting back to the more traditional realpolitik, the realists, that has, since 1945, for the most part, dominated the formulation of American foreign policy, and which has actually shown, apart from some details at the edges, a pretty bipartisan approach to how America handles itself in the outside world. So, in actual fact, I think just for that reason that we've had that the third Bush phase has looked much more conventional, the ability or the willingness of Barack Obama to strike off in a very radically different course will be less obvious. The other thing one has to say about Barack Obama is that the actual legacy, the problems that he's going to inherit from the 20th of January onwards, for some people, it looks like a legacy from hell. And one wonders why one wants to be president of the United States when you're going to inherit a recession tipping into the depression, two wars running in one in Afghanistan and one in Iraq, and a whole host of problems in the wider world at a time when things are looking very fluid and very, very unstable. Be that as it may, that is what he's going to inherit. And I think to answer the second question which I posed, what actually is his scope for change? If you look at the two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, the ability to do something radically different is extremely limited. If you take the case of Iraq, we're now moving into a situation where the party that is dictating the timing and pace of the withdrawal of coalition forces, the initiative, if you like, is draining away from Washington, and certainly drained away from London, and actually, to a very large degree, it is the Iraqis themselves, the Shia-dominated administration in Baghdad, which is setting the timetable and setting the pace. It's worth reading a piece by Ahmed Shalabi in Sunday's New York Times on this, and I'm not saying that he's the necessary typical of representative at the top of the Iraqi administration. So I think there we're not going to see anything radically different from what would have happened, even if, this is maybe a bit contentious, even if John McCain had won the presidency. But there are two areas where he's got more wiggle room, more margin for manoeuvre. And here I think we may see some change, but whether it's change for the better is another matter. One of the things that emerged from the campaign is that Obama and his people seem to regard Iraq as the bad war. After all, he voted against it. Interesting, he's put Hillary Clinton in the Secretary of State, but that's a whole other issue. I'd love to go on about this, but it's Bill's the man who's the expert on domestic policy. Then the idea is that Afghanistan is the good war, the winnable war, the war where what is at stake can be achieved. I personally think that's a load of rubbish. I think actually Afghanistan is even less winnable, quote unquote, than Iraq has proven to be. So it is reasonable to expect that when Barack Obama becomes president, given that General Petraeus will then be commander of CENTCOM, given the publicly expressed wishes of the American commander in Afghanistan, McKernan, plus what we, the Brits, are saying and a number of other NATO allies, that there is going to be some kind of surge of military forces to try and deal with both the military and the political problem. I personally think that this is wasted effort because you can win 1,000 firefights in Helmand province and it doesn't provide you with a stable administration in Kabul. And this is the key problem in Afghanistan, that if you remember your Clausewitz and that war is the extension of politics by other means, it's very hard to see in Afghanistan where the connecting rod is between the war and the politics over here, and it's the politics which will decide the fate of Afghanistan. So I think we will see a greater military effort in Afghanistan than has been the case so far. The interesting thing, for me, the most interesting thing that may emerge and which is desirable from a new Obama foreign policy is whether he's going to do something of a diplomatic surge, and is he going to start talking to the Iranians in an adult fashion. And I think one of the great failures of the Bush presidency in all its three phases is their unwillingness seriously to engage with Iran. Now, I know there were contacts with the Iranians in Iraq, but they never had the kind of political steam that they needed to bear fruit. Now, I'm not one of these people who thinks that the Iran is a kind of victim country and it needs tender, loving care. I think the way you have to come at it is an extremely realistic way. And I think this is what Barack Obama and his advisors detect, that you actually can't achieve anything in Afghanistan, certainly not in Western Afghanistan. You probably can't achieve anything lasting in Iraq. You probably can't achieve anything on the Middle East peace settlement in general because of Iran's influence over Syria, then over Hezbollah, then over Hamas, unless you pull them into the game and treat them like equals. I mean, after all, Persians have been around for several thousand years when we Brits are living in mud huts, and we know we're pretty sophisticated at it. So to treat them as errant children or violent children is absolutely ridiculous. You actually have to start treating them like adults, treating them with some respect. You don't have to love them, you don't have to like them, you don't have to hug Ahmadinejad. I'm not saying anything like that. You just need to bring them into play, because you can't settle these enormous problems unless you can turn them from being part of the problem into being part of the solution. And there's some signs and portents from Obama's campaign and from what has been said by some of his foreign policy advisors that they understand this. And you have to hope that there will be a new administration in Israel that will understand this as well. Now, you put those two things together, if they happen, I think you will have a significant change in American foreign policy, which is going to be one for the better. I don't think we're going to get, how do I put it, airy-fairy multilateralism, which some people, you know, people say it's time to move from unilateralism to multilateralism. Well, what you've always seen in American foreign policy since 1945 is depending on who's president, who's secretary of state, who's national security advisor, a pretty judicious mixture of all the tools that are available to a superpower in foreign policy. Sometimes you go down the multilateral path. If you're clever, you use the big international institutions to advance your national interests. And sometimes you go unilateral when you feel you have to. Obama has said in the campaign that if necessary, if America's interests are involved, he would reserve the right to act unilaterally. What I think we're going to see is using much more profitably than the Bush administration this mixture of tools that have always traditionally been available to the United States. You get some indications from the kinds of people who are in the mix for senior appointments. Leave aside the domestic political aspect of Hillary Clinton's appointment, and once leaving aside a huge lump there, and I'm not going to go in there, there is no reason to expect her being other than a very capable, mainstream, play-it-down-the-middle Secretary of State. We'll see who she appoints inside state, and that will enable us to get a clearer vision of her likely foreign policy. If Bob Gates is kept at at defense, again, you're going to have a very solid and an infinitely superior operator than Don Rumsfeld in this key department. Again, very mainstream, down the center, a Republican, of course, but who could easily fit into a Democratic administration. I'll be interested to see who's national security advisor. The names in play, encouraging. Jim Steinberg, who used to be Sandy Berger's deputy and Bill Clinton's National Security Council. Very tough, very astute, very knowledgeable, with excellent judgment. An alternative is Jim Jones, who used to be commander of the Marine Corps and was secure, wasn't he? Yes. Again, a really good man. Then, of course, you've got down in CENTCOM, you've got General Petraeus, who kind of had the feeling was actually running American foreign policy pretty well through a large chunk of the second Bush administration. Now, how all these individuals, all these moving parts are going to fit together will tell us whether this is going to be an effective foreign policy with the whole greater than the sum of its parts. Above all, what we want to avoid is what happened in the first Bush administration, where the individuals were powerful people of standing, but the whole was significantly less than the sum of its parts, to the dismay of everybody. So, to sum up, I think the scope for change in American foreign policy is not as huge as some people might wish, and that looking at what Obama has said and the kinds of people who are now in contention for the top jobs, what we are likely to see is a reversion to the traditional realist approach to foreign policy, plus one hopes some imagination and willingness to surge diplomacy in tackling the really difficult problems, and most of those are in the Middle East and Asia. I won't talk for the moment about protectionism or climate change and all that. I think that's enough from me.
Thank you very much. Now ask Bill Barnard if he'd speak to us as well.
Just one quick comment. One of the things that strikes me sitting here is how much I agree with what was just said, both about the possibilities of significant change, or rather the more likelihood of little change, and the pessimism about Afghanistan, the optimism about Iran, potential of the use of multiple approaches, and in fact, Gates at defense, all of which I tend to agree with. But let me make two disclaimers at the very start. I'm not an official spokesman for the Obama campaign or the transition team, so I cannot be put in that box. Nor am I an expert in foreign policy. My own field of expertise is domestic politics, but I will share with you, and it might be useful for those of you who are in the field of foreign policy to have some respect for someone who is not. I spoke a great many times over the last 6 months at all sorts of fora in this country. And I always made a number of caveats when I had the inevitable questions about foreign policy. It was clear that those asking the questions had expectations that were sky high and wholly unrealistic. I expect that's not the case of those of you sitting in this room. Still, it's useful, perhaps, to know what I told them and to try to temper their expectations. I told them, first of all, the truism that the strategic interests of the United States do not change with a change in an occupant of the White House. So those expecting Nirvana, those expecting a significant deviation from what has gone before are bound to be disappointed. Nonetheless, there will be a change in mode, manner, tone, tenor, and sometimes of tactics, which can make all the difference in the world in the ability to achieve one's aims. There'll be a shift in emphasis, as everyone knows, from Iraq to Afghanistan, and I would add now, after the last few months, of Pakistan as well. A renewed emphasis on the Middle East peace process. There are other pressing problems in the Middle East, to be sure, but I think you're going to find a significant push there as well. Generally, I did not dwell upon the challenges presented by Iran or newly aggressive Russia, and they could only take so much dampening of their optimism, so I didn't. But let me introduce here certain other elements into the discussion. One result of the current economic crisis is to remind those whose primary interest is in foreign affairs that no great power remains dominant unless its economic base is secure. Much of the energy of the new administration will be a necessity in dealing with the economic crisis and its impact, both short-range and long, on the U.S. Still, even here, there are important implications for foreign relations. We've learned from the lessons of the 1930s that our approach needs to be multilateral, must be multinational. There can be no retreat into protectionism to beggar thy neighbor and end up beggaring everyone that led to such disastrous consequences in the 1930s after the Smoot-Hawley tariff. Still, as an aside, there's a narrow window here in which to take effective action on the economy, because if the downturn deepens and is prolonged, the ability of democratic nations to resist the protectionist urge will be sorely tested. The economic crisis, though, presents a real opportunity. It serves as a catalyst to a redesign of the international financial architecture, one that would take cognizance of the world as it is today, as we are about to enter the second decade of the 21st century, rather than the world, that is, the economic world, as it existed in 1945 or 1948. There will be changes that recognize the emergence of the BRIC nations and of Nigeria as major economic players, along with the development of significant players elsewhere in Asia and South America. It is the economic crisis that is focusing minds on these problems and that offers that rare opportunity to make significant change. There are ramifications for other institutions, to be sure, beyond the purely economic, the UN, for example, the other foreign and regional organizations that now exist. So too, domestically. It's similar to the situation in international affairs, I'm going to suggest, is somewhat similar to what's true of American domestic policy. As an aside here, I often have to explain to people from unitary states, especially those with parliamentary systems, how different the American system is. The U.S. president to those abroad seems all-powerful, and it is true that in foreign affairs he has greater scope than in any other aspect of the government. But domestically, the founding fathers so feared concentrated power that they divided it between branches of government and levels of government, so that the president is much less powerful in all but foreign policy than is the British prime minister, for example. He does not necessarily command an effective majority in Congress, even on issues on which he or his party campaign. So it's very difficult to make fundamental changes in the U.S. domestically. There are really only two times when you have that opportunity. One is in a period of crisis, not unlike the 1930s, not unlike the period we're in now. The other is when an issue has been around so long, has been chewed over so much, and all the possible political advantage has been extracted from it, that a consensus gradually emerges and you can move forward, which is, I think, will be the case on health care in this particular administration. How does that relate to the foreign policy area? I don't want to succumb to the same unblinking and unthinking Obama mania that many in the audiences that I addressed earlier did succumb to, I think. But I do believe that the current economic crisis that faces all governments may aid in breaking through encrusted positions and permit some startling and rather significant breakthroughs on the international front. It's not perhaps entirely coincidental that on the front page of the FT today, there's a little squib, a little box, that points out that the president of Pakistan has now proposed a free trade arrangement with India and further efforts at peaceful efforts to cooperate between the two. And that in the same paragraph is mentioned the prospect of an IMF loan. Now, this is not a crude quid pro quo. I don't mean to suggest that. But I mean that the crisis has the ability to permit people all of a sudden to break through decisions they've taken in the past and perhaps imagine other possibilities. If Pakistan, for example, is more secure on its southern and western border, it might very well be able to take more effective action in the tribal areas, for example. These things are all interlinked. One other area that, in many ways, the currency of the appeal of certain areas in foreign policy varies over time. We had a period when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s when Russia was the area you wanted to concentrate on. Well, in a funny kind of way, we've sort of gotten away from that and forgotten a lot about that until the more recent events of this summer. And I think we are again going to have to think through how it is we relate to Russia. She seems to alternate at times between a strong sense of victimization, a victim of a hostile world, and an effort to be more aggressive and to be more forceful in her approach to the wider world. I think one of the more disturbing things, as I understand it, that is perceived among many observers of Russia is the change in the cast of mind, the frame of reference that many in Russia are now adopting. If you think back to 6 years ago, let's say, there were a lot of points of contention between the West, between the U.S. and Russia. Serbia, Kosovo, criticism of what was going on in Chechnya, a whole range of things. But nonetheless, the rhetoric was at a much lower level and the actions were at a much less intense level than they are now. Certainly they were not happy with the taking into NATO of Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania. And certainly they were not happy with the prospect of others being taken in. But the level, the reaction was just very different. It was gauged very differently. And I think it was gauged very differently because it fell within a frame of reference where they understood and accepted that these were differences between themselves and the U.S., but not necessarily differences that meant there wasn't a long-term compatibility in the aims of the two nations. I think that's changed. It's changed in part for domestic reasons. Putin has found that domestically it's very helpful for him to take the stance that he's taken towards the West. The military has certainly found it very helpful in seeing their appropriations increase significantly over the last 5 years. And there are others in what Eisenhower would call for America, the military-industrial complex, who benefit from that greater aggression, that greater forcefulness as well. But I do think that there is a possibility of carefully gauging when and where you push back, when and where you accommodate the understandable desires and fears of Russia. And I think that we can have some degree of optimism that some progress might be made there. I'll leave it at that.